So what are you supposed to do between each Engadget podcast? Wait in silence? I'm Matt Smith, and every morning I walk through the day's biggest tech stories. It's short, relevant, and ready for listening whenever you wake up. Find Engadget Morning Edition wherever you find your podcasts, or ask your smart speaker for the latest news from Engadget.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Engadget podcast. I'm reviews editor Sherlyn Lowe, and my usual co-host, Devendra, is out dealing with an interstate move, so he's not here today. But not to worry, I have plenty, and I mean plenty, of other guests with me today, starting with senior editor Dan Cooper, all the way from London. He's going to be my guest co-host today. Dan, hello.
Hello, it's a pleasure to be here, and thank you for having me.
Dan's here because he's one of the people that covers wearables with me on Engadget, and he covers a lot of health-related stuff. And today is kind of the episode that I earmarked for this big telehealth dive. But I completely forgot that Apple had planned to have its developer conference, WWDC, this week. So we're going to have to break all that news down. If you're enjoying the show, as always, please make sure to leave us a review on iTunes, subscribe on your favorite podcast platform, and leave us a nice email at podcast@engadget.com. If you prefer, we have a nifty little contact form on the page that this podcast episode is on the Engadget website. So go over there to look for it. Apple had its WWDC developer conference this week, and one of our many guests to join us this episode to talk about that is senior mobile editor Chris Velasco. Hello, V.
Hey, pal. How's it going?
It's good, first of all. Happy birthday. I want the
Thank
whole world
you.
To know.
I'm 24. It feels so good.
That's a lie.
I'm in my early 30s. Thank you very much for reminding everybody. But I appreciate that. That's very sweet.
You had to have a very heavy Apple week on your birthday week, which I don't know if it's fun for you. Certainly,
I don't know if it's fun either, but it's definitely how it always works out. Like, if you look at the last 2 years of, like, Apple public beta releases, they went out on my birthday both times. So
that's life. Dan, me and you, we were all like all hands on deck covering WWDC, and thank goodness everyone was kind of helping because there was a lot of stuff this year. Like, I don't think WWDC has ever been this busy, but am I wrong? Like,
I mean, Apple definitely touches on all of these categories every year, but I think it's fair to say that this by far was one of the most, if not the most impactful WWDC in terms of just pure change, right? We saw a pretty significant redesign for iOS. Apple's taking that in a direction we've never really seen it go before. Obviously, there is the big transition to Apple Silicon, which is going to play out over the next 2 years or maybe a little bit less. Big changes for watchOS, including some that we've been waiting for a long time. Mm-hmm. You can start a car with an iPhone. Like, the list really does go on. It was a jam-packed two-hour keynote for sure.
And you guys, you and our editor-in-chief, Dana Woolman, live-blogged the event. Did that feel like breakneck pace for you? Is this the first time you had to like live-blog WWDC from like remote, right? You weren't there in person.
Yeah.
So there wasn't the usual like pause for applause that like Apple, you know, does on this keynote so you have time to breathe.
I mean, look, there's a huge difference between trying to live blog an Apple event in a convention center versus the relative comfort of my basement where I have a bathroom and some coffee and power outlets. Like, it was bizarre, but also because of the context around it, one of the easiest live blogs I've ever had to do.
Oh, that's good. I'm glad it was at least a bit chill. Dan, what did you feel watching WWDC from your time zone?
It was super scattergun, I think, just in terms of, it wasn't as if they were sort of dropping these big bombs every sort of 5 or 10 minutes. It was like every minute and a half, oh, by the way, we're adding this, and boom, we're adding this. It was like a shopping channel thing where they're like, but wait, here's more. And now you can get one with a blender, and you can add app clips, and oh, by the way, we're switching to ARM. Boom.
Oh my goodness. Absolutely. I mean, so let's totally just do, like, break down the news. I think that the stuff that will mean the most, I think, to people is the iOS 14 updates. V, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely, in terms of install base, this is the one that's going to affect the most people, and it's definitely going to take some people time to get used to what Apple has done. So for those who haven't really been keeping track of the news, iOS 14 can look like regular iOS if you want it to, but there are but there is support for widgets now, which is something Apple sort of introduced a couple years ago with like the Today View. Certain apps would have widgets that lived in its own separate space, but now you can drag those out of the Today View, resize them, and put them anywhere on your home screen. Obviously, having more stuff on your home screen tends to push around the apps that you've already installed. So instead of just forcing you to have multiple app pages, there is now the app library, which is where you're basically meant to put all of the apps that you need sort of regularly, but don't really have to look at all of the time.
I have to say, as an Android user who was on Twitter during this keynote, people were like, Android's done this for years. And it was a lot of fun to watch. Do you think iOS, you know, took its time and has implemented this kind of better than Android?
Yes and no. I think the widgets definitely look better than what we've seen on Android. I mean, you raise a good point, right? Like, widgets have been a part of the Android experience basically since, like, Android 1.0, the right. HTC G1, like, this was a foundational thing for Android. But
yes.
it does kind of feel like after a while, developers who had made widgets just didn't really seem to feel the need to update them or have them do more.
Yeah, because people stop using them too, right? Like,
yeah.
Everyone just wants icons now.
Which is like, you know, we'll see how that plays out on the Apple front. Like, maybe people on iOS just, they got used to not having widgets and now they don't need them. You know, that's a distinct possibility. But in terms of the app library, that's another very sort of Android-y kind of addition to the experience. But I feel like I kind of prefer the simpler approach that you get on Android, right? So with maybe not all Android devices, but a lot of companies use launchers where you have home screens and, you know, apps that you download sort of populate there and you can organize them as you wish. But then you have the launcher, which is separate and just has all of your apps. I kind of wish Apple had gone that direction because what we have with the app library, it's meant to be a little more AI infused. There's more sort of intelligent curation going on, but it doesn't always seem to make sense, right? Like, Apple has said that apps that go into the library get sorted automatically. Those categories roughly correspond to the categories in the App Store, but not always. So we've heard of situations where, like, the lifestyle folder has like 90% of your apps, and then all of the other ones that fit more neatly into other buckets get like sections of their own. Like, it's not a completely uniform thing yet, and it feels like Apple still really needs to tune some of this stuff before the public beta is released next month.
Okay. I mean, I completely agree. On Android, these suggested apps still aren't great. I mean, also, like, coming off of the Android 11 beta coverage that we did maybe a week or two ago, it was interesting to see what Apple was bringing compared to what Android 11 was playing around with. So we'll see. Dan, you're an iOS user?
Yes.
I think?
Yes. Oh, boy. I'm a never Android type. I'm sorry to say.
No. How dare you? You're never getting another Android device to review here from here again. Never.
I'm very sorry. It's fine.
What do you think?
So, the one thing that I'm not concerned about, but it's like, if you have the swipe right sort of on the left pane, you already have all of those kind of the things where you would put your notifications and your widgets and everything else.
Yeah.
And I kind of feel like Apple, instead of doing one thing well, you now have a pull-down menu at the top, which has notifications. You can now put those widgets on your home screen, and you can have the right swipe to go to this left contextual menu that also has all of this stuff. And I feel like, rather than them just doing one thing and doing it well, you now have three kind of half-assed ways of doing this. And the thing about with this AI curation is, as V says, Apple and AI and machine learning are not necessarily, especially when you know, it's about anticipating what you need. It's never been very good at that.
And, no, not yet.
And I'm really dubious. It's a nice idea to cut down on the amount of cruft on all those home screen pages. But the idea that, because they never found a way of letting you organize, back in like the iPhone 4 and previous era, you could hook your phone up to iTunes and actually organize your home screen with keyboard and mouse, so you could like manage all of these hundreds of apps on your phone really easily. When that link kind of got severed and you had to do it all on the device, it became an absolute nightmare. And mm-hmm. Apple still have never really worked on a solution for that. And all of this now seems like they're just desperately trying to find a way of putting the mayonnaise back in a jar. And not very well.
I mean, there's still a lot more to iOS 14 we kind of have to go through. But Will, I think you do raise a very good point that we might get back to. I do think, though, that like there are things that Apple does well that I, as an Android user, can only look on longingly. I think messages, when the keynote was getting around to the messages updates, I was like, holy crap, this is great. I don't know about you guys, because I don't know that everyone reacted the same way I did. But as someone stuck on like really terrible text-based messaging, it was nice to see the group features, the inline replies, the fact that you can react to individual messages for a while now. It's nice. G, what did you think?
Yeah, I mean, no one really knows this, but like you and I and like a lot of our mutual friends like communicate exclusively in Telegram. So
yeah.
The idea that like now we can share those features with other people,
yep.
It's like finally, like it's not a huge deal for me necessarily, because at this point I've been very successful in convincing everyone I know to be on Telegram.
Right, same.
But if you're an iMessage diehard, if you're the kind of person who just like refuses to talk to anyone else unless they have a blue text bubble, sure, great. Welcome to like 2 years ago. We were glad to have you.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the features introduced are very Slack-like or things that WhatsApp and Telegram already sort of have. But I mean, I still have friends who just can't seem to get off of text and move on to something like Telegram. I mean, Dan, I mean, this is less of an, I don't know, do you use Telegram to chat with your friends or some other chat app, or are you reliant on like iMessage?
So I don't think I use iMessage for anything other than like the text message that I get from my doctor's surgery, because everyone I know is WhatsApp. And I think if you ask anyone in Britain, they'll probably say the same thing. WhatsApp has basically swallowed everything else whole. And I have tried to get them onto Telegram, but I think it's that stickiness. You know, if I was a thought leader, I would say it's about network effects. It's the network effect, you know, WhatsApp with the Facebook integration, everything else has got the network effect.
Is that your thought leader voice?
Yeah.
Okay.
If I ever get to do a TED talk.
I love when you put on your Thinkfluencer hat.
I am a think. No, I'm not. I could try.
You are, sort of.
But yeah, as a consequence, iMessage just isn't a thing. And I know that there's like the text message bubble thing is a thing in the US, but it kind of feels like, you know, it's kind of like everyone complaining that their horse isn't fast enough, and we're over here going, oh yes, well, we're driving these things called cars now.
Well, okay. I mean, look, I still think that that's an interesting thing to see coming from the land where RCS still isn't real yet. Some of the updates I mentioned on messages, just so the listener that might not be up to date can know, are like, yeah, like you can have a group icon for, like, you can use an emoji or a picture for your group text now in iMessage, which, wow, nice. You can have, again, you can reply directly to someone's message. You can have inline replies, so I think they show up threaded, like in Slack. So I think those are nice ways to like organize communication. But again, like everyone has pointed out, this is not very new. There were a whole lot of other updates just for iOS alone, and we haven't even got around to the rest of the stuff yet. So like, I'm gonna just quickly shout through some of them. Maps got a bunch of updates. You've got like some environmentally more conscious routes, I guess EV driving routes. You've also got bike routes with better information included. Siri is getting less intrusive on your screen. There's also some new translation features. There's this thing called app clips. Holy crap, there's just like a lot. V, did I miss out anything?
No, I think you hit the
really?
Big stuff. No, I think you hit the big stuff, but the thing is like each of those things is like the subject of like a 25-minute conversation by
good
themselves,
Lord, yeah.
Right?
Call out, tell me what your favorite and like why, I guess.
App clips is like definitely where I'm spending most
of
my
brain
processing time. I don't know that I'm necessarily hype. I think I'm really spending this time trying to figure out when I would legitimately use one of these things. Like, I get what Apple's after, and to all of the people out there saying that this existed in Android,
you're
absolutely correct. Google
yes.
Play Instant Apps have been a thing for a while. But I don't know. People think I'm biased because I spend a lot of time reporting on Apple, but I use Android a lot, and I cannot tell you the last time I saw an instant Android app in use.
Yeah. Yeah, so, I agree.
So seeing Apple approach this with a very sort of situational and in some cases very rooted in physical approach, right, with QR codes and NFC tags, it sounds great. And I think some of the things Apple has done around app clips makes a lot of sense. Like, for example, if you install an app clip for, say, parking meters, which is, I think, an example they pointed out during the keynote. Some people were concerned that, you know, what happens to the app clip once you're done with that transaction? Do you have to go through the whole process again? So what happens is the app clip stays on the phone for a couple days. If it doesn't get used, iOS deletes it. If it does get used again, developers then have the ability to serve different experiences. So, you know, you could switch to like a top-up mode as opposed to a new parking meter session view. So like there's a lot of really interesting ways for developers to kind of build core functionality into these very, very quick experiences. But I don't think anyone has a really great idea of what the ideal app clip situation looks like.
I think, yeah, you're right. Like, a lot of the scenarios they painted during the keynote seem very interesting to me. And you know what? To the people who are shouting that Android has had instant apps, I think the fact that a lot of people forgot speaks to how little it was used, or maybe how subtle it was. And if that's the case, that's a good thing. But I've been on Android forever, and I haven't seen an instant app pop up in like 3 or 4 years. So it's I think when Apple introduces something like that and people get convinced, that's when we see uptake in use. Like when they made Apple Watch, now everyone's wearing an Apple Watch, and smartwatches had been around forever before that.
Well, you're not wearing an Apple Watch.
No, I'm not. I'm wearing one of my many Android watches, which Dan will no longer get from me, by the way. No longer. But Dan, what was your favorite?
Do you know what? I wanna talk about app clips. I wanna be like
two. Miss Congeniality over
I'm
here.
Sorry.
App clips.
I'm so sorry. I feel like I'm gonna be like the Rush Limbaugh of this now, but I think the existence of app clips is basically an indictment of Apple's app development over the last maybe 4 or 5 years. Because in the example in the keynote where they're like, you go, you walk up to a scooter and you download the scooter app, except it's a super compressed version of the scooter app that has to be no bigger than 10 megabytes. Like, if you're in a bad signal area, which, you know, they do exist, if your coverage sucks, that's still going to be a laborious thing to do. And the
isn't it better than installing an entire app that might be like 50 megabytes instead?
Okay, so
something?
why is that app 50 megabytes? Like, all apps should be about 10 megabytes. Like, the most comprehensively large
app, should.
Right? Should
they
be.
They should. But there's no
megabytes.
Such restriction right now.
No, there isn't. Yeah. And like, the Facebook app is something crazy. I think the last time I did an update, it was like 200 megabytes.
Something. Yep.
That is just lazy development. It's lazy. Backwards development where everyone just doesn't think about usability. It's the Chrome problem, whereby all of these various departments in Google's just kind of pile on crap onto this thing to make it buggy and a RAM hog and really inefficient. And because there's no incentive to like streamline it. So now we're having to basically create apps. They're apps again, except they're small again. I just make them do it properly the first time. Rant ends.
I don't know. I take issue with this idea of apps having not been made quote unquote properly for the last however many years. Like, I think we can agree there are definitely situations where you want an app that does a lot of things. Like, I am very glad that Facebook does a bunch of garbage. Do I use it most of the time? No, but I use it sometimes, and I leave the app on my phone in case that happens. But if I'm buying a sandwich, I'm not going to bother with like the Togo app or the Subway app. Like,
exactly.
I'm going to go in and like engage in this very specific transaction, be done with it, presumably on my phone, assuming the coverage is good, within a couple seconds, because, you know, I signed in with Apple and paid with like my Apple Pay situation. Mm-hmm. And like, that's it. You're absolutely right in that some apps don't need to be super complex, but that's not Apple's fault. That's the fault of the developers who just want more. They've been taught that more is better when it comes to stickiness. And, you know, that's
not
always the case.
Is that stickiness? Is that stickiness? For example, I have a loyalty card with like a salad place because I'm healthy and everything. And I go in there for a juice every week. in the past, after a workout class, and I have the loyalty app on my phone because, yeah, they give me points whenever I buy another smoothie, and I collect those points. And then I think that's the reason I need to have the app, is to keep collecting those points. Otherwise, if I could just like scan a promotional code I used to have through an app clip, I would totally just do that and never stick around for the points after. You know what I mean? Does that make any sense? Am I talking?
No, I get it. But let me throw this out there and see if this like kind of addresses what you're talking about. Like there's never going to be a situation where an app clip exists independently of an app. Like Apple has made it very clear. Right. Like you as a developer have to submit the app and the app clip at the same time. If you submit just the app clip, even if it's perfectly functional by itself, it will be rejected. So
I
think there's this concern that we're looking at a potential fork in the road where developers will try and choose one sort of paradigm for app creation, you know, big, full-featured, classic experience versus these very lightweight transactional ones. But they're by design from Apple meant to be tied together all the way through.
Okay.
Does it?
Here's the thing I want to jump in though, right? If these are apps that are primarily focused on transactions, and we'll come back to your smoothie place or your salad place example.
I want to go back there too, yeah.
Yeah. That's what Apple Pay is for. Like, surely it would be easier if Apple simply kind of did the hard yards in terms of getting business listings, getting engagement on that level, and then when you go to your map, you can maybe pre-order through the map. You turn up, you tap with Apple Maps, Apple Pay, and you pay. And then that way you're not troubling your cellular bill by having to download yet another app, even if it is one that disappears. There are better ways of doing this.
Sure. What happens if I don't have Apple Pay and I'm on Google Pay?
You're not going to have Google app clips anyway. So
that is another thing that I think there's a little confusion around. So I can't vouch for Google Pay, but I have been told that if you are wanting to use a service that has an app that you might have an account with, but you you log in through Facebook or Google or something that isn't signed in with Apple, that continues to work. I'm also told that if you have a payment method that isn't stored in Apple Pay, you can choose to use that as well. The exact mechanics of how that's presented to you as a user, I'm not sure because I and basically everyone else, like, we don't know what app clips really look like. Yeah. But, like, there will be support in there for, like, it's not going to be a blatant attempt to, like, squeeze you into the Apple ecosystem.
Oh, yeah.
It might be, but it's not designed that way.
For me, it's not. I mean, no, I was more taking issue with the fact that Dan's like, well, app clips are good, but why don't you use Apple Pay instead? And I'm like, well, I don't have Apple Pay. Well, how else is Apple going to get me to use iPhone or how is the developer going to get me to use their app if I don't have Apple Pay? Or serve me promotions. You know what I mean? Like, obviously, they should then work with Google on there. And so it basically, I think, creating an app for a store owner or something like that. That's their way of providing kind of a platform agnostic experience. Because otherwise, they have to go through the process of, like, talking to Apple Pay and then talking to Google Pay and talking to WePay and whatever. And then making sure that they're, you know, qualifying for all of that. I mean, I can see why for the consumer it would be obviously better if it were all just bundled into Apple Pay, Google Pay, whatever else pay. But I guess this is just easier for a business, right? To like create one thing, hopefully that supports all, even though they also have to support protocols within their app anyway to like, I mean, I'm getting deep into some sort of developer speak here.
Do it, man.
But you know what I mean? Like you have to, of course, adopt. But I have a feeling that it might be easier for them just to bundle all of that into their one app platform. But Dan, you were saying we want to go back to my smoothie place.
Yeah, I want to go back. I want to go and get a smoothie right now.
I do.
I will fly over to get a smoothie.
We will.
Yeah, can we do this? We're sitting under blankets right now, and it's really hot, so the smoothie sounds really good.
I mean, yeah. So, okay, but other than iOS, there was like updates across the Apple ecosystem. We heard about iPadOS, watchOS, macOS, Pencil Car Key, AirPods. What came out of the iPadOS update?
So the thing to bear in mind about iPadOS is that even though Apple kind of treats it as a project with its own priorities and objectives, it's still based on iOS 14, right? So like everything that we've talked about, including app clips, which doesn't really seem like it would make as much sense on a big screen, that's coming to the iPad experience too. The handful of like very iPad-specific things are they're cool. They're great if you're, especially great if you're like a pencil person, right? Like I'm not a huge doodler or note taker, but you can now with the new scribble feature write in any text field and have that automatically converted into actual manipulable text. Like you can copy and paste it and do whatever you have to do. It does seem really quite nice. It's basically what we saw on like the Galaxy Note.
Right? I was going to say, it's the S Pen. It's basically the S Pen.
It's the S Pen, but like a size someone would actually want to use.
Yeah. Okay.
I talk about size a lot. What are you going to do?
Go for it. Yeah.
Beyond that, there are some additions to ARKit that kind of take advantage of what Apple is now doing in iPads with the LiDAR sensor, so improved depth recognition. We're seeing Apple sort of move into very locational AR with this feature called Location Anchors, which basically gives developers the ability to tie some piece of AR content to a very highly specific point on the globe, so anyone in that area can whip out their phone and point it at the same direction and more or less see the same thing.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of AR has been working on that recently. Like location-based AR has been the next step and next generation. So it's nice to see Apple do this. I agree with you. I'm all about the pencil updates, but the rest of the iPadOS updates don't seem to be that impressive to me. Just because, like you said, it's all the iOS stuff.
No, I totally agree. We got the bifurcation of iOS and iPadOS last year. And I feel like that's like as big as Apple needed to get for a while. I think what's really kind of interesting is when you look at the design of something like iPadOS now, which has like new menu bars and like sidebars and stuff. Like there are definite nods to like a quote unquote more traditional computer experience. And I think it's also interesting to see that the inverse of that play out on macOS, right? You've got a control center, you've got really big targets that look like they might be able to be used by fingers at some point. Like we're looking at the desktopification of iPadOS and the iPadization of macOS.
Look, I mean, I sniggered a little bit while you were talking about iPadOS there, but I need to remember that Android doesn't have an equivalent yet, so I need to eat some humble pie right now.
I mean, no, you're fine, but like let's take this opportunity to call on the Android developers of the world. Like, hey, tablets are a thing. Can you just like do better tablet apps? Like
they're still here.
Maybe there's not as much money there, but like I'll pay for it. That's something, right?
No. Great. Not you. Okay. we gotta keep going, you guys, because there's a lot. So there was also macOS, like you said, V, but before that, watchOS 7 got a bunch of updates. Dan, do you want to fill us in on what, you know, were the updates for watchOS 7?
So the big one, or the big ones, are sleep tracking. Finally, sleep tracking on Apple Watch.
Holy crap.
It's only taken us 2 million years before an Apple Watch offers at least first-party sleep tracking.
Yep.
And I kind of feel like that's long overdue, but also it's still an indictment that they advertise Apple Watch's battery life at 18 hours, so you still have to charge it once every 24 hours anywhere you're meant to. And then you get the hand-washing, which is very important right now.
Can we just really quickly talk about how, like, technically specific this thing is? Like it senses the motion of your hands and matches it against what it thinks hand washing looks like, and then uses the microphone to listen to the sound of running water to confirm.
That's my favorite part, honestly. That's my favorite part, because like that's the accelerometer can only get you that far. You never know what else a person could be doing with their hands with those motions. Let's just
family show. Come on.
You could be greeting a person the Chinese way when you're saying "Gong Xi Fa Cai," Happy New Year. That could be similar to hand washing looking. But the turning on the microphone, I think, is both a genius move and a potential privacy issue. I don't know. I mean, there are also things that could sound like water and soap. But anyway.
So, dance what else tracking. Comes from... Let's talk about dance tracking.
Yeah, dance tracking. Very, very... Another very interesting feature that got added to watchOS 7 in the new fitness app. Dan, what do you think?
I think if they can pull this off, and I will reserve judgment until I try it, but I'm really excited. If they're able to judge dance, or even just if it's just a case whereby you hit dance and it just calculates whatever random movements of your arm, and it's like, oh yeah, okay, we'll just write all this off as dance and your heart rate is 102 or whatever, therefore you
yeah
have done
that's
some
what
exercise.
I think
it's probably the thing that a lot of people who go to like Zumba and classes of that nature have been waiting for. And
I'm raising my hand, you can't see it, but it's
no.
me.
But it kind of rounds out. I don't think there are many other kind of big categories of sports or you know, vigorous exercise activities that Apple could really add to the watch.
Yeah. Yeah. We were just talking about accelerometer stuff. I mean, the way that Apple is implementing this is interesting. They've decided that, you know, they have to combine the horizontal movement of your arms with the vertical up and down of your legs when you're dancing to detect when you are dancing. And I think that that's the only way that they're using it to detect that you're dancing and then count it towards your exercise. I don't think that they're being more specific than that is what I'm saying. So once they recognize that you've started some sort of dance, they're going to like track your heart rate and your calories burned maybe. But for me, again, I've spent like all of this pandemic playing Just Dance as a way to get my workout on. So I think that for me, this is going to be a good feature if I ever get to try it. And yeah, Dan, you're right. Sleep tracking at last is really, really important. Everyone else has got it already, so Apple's late to that, but Dan's, they are the first, I think, to introduce something like this. I haven't seen it on Fitbit, I haven't seen it on Garmin, I haven't seen it on Wear OS or Tizen OS, so I'm
trying to dredge the back of my memory just in case someone like Withings or someone had it as like as one of those auto detect ones.
Yeah. Yeah.
But
maybe
nothing's coming up.
I don't think so. No one's really thought about Dan's this way yet. So I think that good on Apple for including that. You know, next time you go clubbing, when we go into clubs again, you could be working out according to Apple. V, what do you think about the macOS updates? Because they're now getting a bit more mobile-like.
It's fine. Well, so here's the thing. We sort of knew going into this very little about the macOS experience, and which is a surprise because that usually gets leaked. Maybe not as thoroughly as everything else, but like it gets some attention. And going into this, we knew nothing. So things like this redesign, it's a pleasant surprise, I guess. I appreciate the new aesthetic, although I know a lot of people who just think it's hideous. But to touch on what I said earlier, like, yeah, I think we're seeing a lot of like it's now easier to see how macOS and something like iPadOS could converge or at least share a lot of the same design elements down the road. But obviously, the big macOS news is that Apple is moving to Apple Silicon with its ARM chips. So developers are going to have to figure out how to translate, recompile, reconfigure whatever their existing apps to work with this new hardware.
I think it will be interesting to see. I think that, you know, computer companies have been trying to make some sort of version of their software work on ARM forever. I mean, we know Windows on ARM is a very, very good effort on their part.
It's hit or miss, shall we say.
I don't even really know. I wanted to say like they're challenged, but it will be interesting to see how Apple deals with it. I think we heard today that some apps might not work. I can't remember exactly was it Basecamp or something
Boot
like that?
Camp.
That might not, Bootcamp. Basecamp is something else, isn't it? So it does sound like Apple has a lot to do, and I think a 2-year transition therefore makes sense. But why do you think then they had to announce it now, so far ahead of time?
Well, they've got to give developers as much of a head start as possible, right? Because if the end result is all of their Mac products are running on ARM by, you know, the end of 2021, early 22, like whatever exactly the time frame is. Some apps, as they pointed out several times during the keynote, some people have already been working with the sort of universal binary in mind. So for those people, you like tweak your code, you recompile, and you're basically good to go.
Yeah.
But there are obviously a lot of other players, including, I would assume, quite big ones, that maybe weren't as privy to some of this stuff in advance. And they're starting from scratch, right? Like Microsoft, we know they're working on bringing the Office suite to new Macs as a universal binary. But as we pointed out, Bootcamp doesn't work. We don't know like what else that they offer would not function at this point. Ditto for Adobe, right? Like we've seen in the keynote that Photoshop seems to work, Lightroom seems to work, which is astonishing because on every machine I've ever used it on, Lightroom runs like effing garbage. So to see it work, to see it work pretty well on an ARM-powered Mac, that's very heartening. But these are huge players, right? Like, who knows how everyone else is going to manage this?
Caveat that obviously we were watching it during a keynote. It was very well rehearsed. In fact, it was like a pre-recorded keynote.
Oh, yeah. So they shot this thing way in advance.
Yeah. So obviously it's going to be smooth. Lightroom will likely still run effing slow and garbage on an ARM-based Mac. Dan, you sometimes cover Windows PCs for us. What do you think about this?
I am excited to see what happens, and I'm excited to see how they manage the transition. In a way, it's kind of it's funny because they're basically going back to an RASC thing from because PowerPC was essentially RASC, so this is kind of familiar territory. And what was weird was just how similar the way that they sold it was. If you go back and watch the Steve Jobs video from the PowerPC transition, in many ways, it felt like they'd just taken that script and just rewritten it to sound different. But the thing that really interests me about all of this is... And Shay, you probably are the person to ask about this because, like, when a company is buying an Intel chip, they're not paying retail price. But for some of those kind of higher end Core i7 chips, they're probably costing maybe $200 per unit. Maybe a little
I couldn't
bit
tell you the exact price, but it would be expensive for sure. Yeah.
And so I'm really curious as to whether Apple says, okay, well, now we're not slinging Intel stuff and we're not paying these hideous licensing fees and we're not buying these chips from a third party, whether the ARM MacBook Pro 2022 edition is $200 or $300 less because they're saving all of that money.
Knowing Apple, I suspect that they won't.
Yeah. There's like a firm consumer understanding of what a MacBook Pro costs. They could take money off the table, but it's Apple, so we know that they won't.
Oh, yeah, they won't. They'll probably like bundle in some software license things and then say, like, here's the extra goodies you get for that money. Maybe. I don't know. I will say that, like, I feel a little bit bad for Intel. Apple seems to have completely ditched them now. There's no more Intel chips being used, I think, after this transition. Am I wrong, V? I can't remember now.
They will continue to make Intel-powered Macs for a little while, but yeah, once they've like made the shift, that's it.
Yeah.
Although, hang on, I've opened my mouth, that was a mistake. Isn't Thunderbolt 3, I think they'll still have to buy like some kind of panel from Intel if they want to keep supporting Thunderbolt 3.
Which is why we're hearing some rumors or rumblings of support for Thunderbolt 4, which might move away from that. I don't know fully yet the details on that, so I might have it wrong eventually. But Thunderbolt 3 is kind of an Apple Intel thing anyway, right? It's like not purely Intel.
Intel's going to lurk around. They might not be the star of the show.
They'll still make some money off of some licensing, but probably and elsewhere too. They're definitely facing stiff competition from AMD, Qualcomm. So, you know, honestly, good luck Intel. I know we were talking about Apple, but we've pivoted to saying good luck Intel. There were other things new with macOS. I mean, Safari got a huge redesign. It's now customizable or more than before. You get like better using tabs, but I am still going to use Chrome everywhere I go. V, did Safari interest you?
I like Safari in theory, if only because if I ever go out and cover an event live again, Safari is the browser you have to use on a Mac so your computer doesn't die in an hour and a half.
The battery saving.
I mean, and that's the thing, right? Like, Safari is great at that. ARM in general is great at that. So if Apple is able to give us the battery life that they're promising without compromising too much on performance, that's going to be really big. But Safari specifically has a lot going for it. Like, it's very clean. It's very fast. Tabs are better now. You can now, like, you get better extensions. You now have the ability to, like, click on a shield in the address bar to see what trackers are being used on a site that you go to. Like, Safari, it's never really been Apple's most popular bit of software. It gets kind of a bad rap, honestly.
Yep.
But they're making changes. Like, it's getting better. It's not going to change your mind if you don't use it already, but it's nice to see that they're still plugging away on it.
You mentioned the shield thing in Safari. Privacy was one of the things that Apple pointed out as part of its like keynote. There are a lot of other things. I think, though, like, I mean, again, we've mentioned before, Pencil, AirPods. I keep saying AirPods. AirPods, car key, lots of other stuff. Go check out Engadget.com for the full coverage for all of that stuff. But I do want a quick shout out to privacy. I think that some parts of the privacy stuff, like giving you, I don't know, like more temporary permission settings for certain apps and websites, was a little bit of catch up to the Google front. But otherwise, I think Apple has always done maybe a better job with privacy than others. V, did any of the privacy stuff interest you at all?
I mean, it does to an extent, but not to the point where I'm like gung-ho about it, mostly because most of my information was like, I'm in the keynote, I'm live blogging, let's internalize as much of this as possible and then just kind of move on. But Apple has, if nothing else, always talked the best game about privacy. They're very, very good at it. I will say Android's approach to notifications with respect to permissions probably feels a little better, just because, I don't know, like they've had more time
more
to think
control.
About it.
Also yeah, more exactly. Control. Yeah, for the user. Dan, what do you think?
The report cards in the App Store, that's going to be such an inflammatory thing. It's brilliant. It's so clever because, again, you'll go to download Google Mail, you go to download Facebook, all of these rival apps, and Apple is, you know, there's going to be this pop-up saying, oh, by the way, here are all the things we admit to doing to you, and... Apple basically win twice over because they say, oh, you know, we care about you. We're empowering you to make the decision.
Right.
And then force all of their rivals to basically cop to doing some things that people may not be comfortable with. I mean, a lot of people aren't going to care, but I reckon there will be a small percentage of people who will see all of the things that these apps are looking for and think, eh, maybe I'll switch to Apple's own calendar app.
I like that during the keynote they used it. They used a metaphor of a nutritional label for your privacy as what this means, what this report card is. Reminds me of, I think it was just last episode when Devendra was talking about Logitech doing something similar for the amount of carbon it uses in its products. Nutritional labels for the greenness or the carbon friendliness of their products. So it seems like people are adopting something similar across the board. Again, a lot of these things are developer stage. We haven't seen them roll out yet. We can expect to see them later this year. Yeah, clearly we're exhausted from talking about WWDC, but we'd love to hear what your favorite announcement out of Apple's developer conference was. So make sure to send us an email. Tell us all about it at podcast@engadget.com. V, you still have so much work to do. We're going to let you go. Thank you so much for joining us today, V.
Thanks for having me, guys. It's always
Happy
fun.
Birthday, V.
Oh, thanks, Dan.
Now we have another guest joining us on the show today. We have Chrissy Farr, health and health tech reporter from CNBC, here to talk all about the telehealth and healthcare industry. Chrissy, how are you doing?
I am good. Thanks for having me on.
Oh my gosh, thank you for joining us so early in the day for you. I feel really bad about it.
Oh, it's not too early. I'm kind of an early riser, so this is great.
I love the big Brit energy we've got going on right now. We're going to keep talking a little bit. I know we might be a bit tired of talking about Apple, but you did also recently publish an article on CNBC, Chrissy, about what Apple may or may not be doing in the healthcare industry. Can you tell us a little bit about your report?
Yeah, of course. So I've been covering Apple and its moves into health for a long time now. For a couple years, they weren't saying anything about it, but just hiring a lot of people out of the industry mysteriously. Yeah. And then finally, they started to speak up and they came out with the watch, and we started to see things like heart rate tracking. And over time, that became more sophisticated. I think one of the problems that they face and almost every tech company faces is that they have a hard time straddling kind of the line between what's wellness and what's medical.
Yeah.
And it's really hard to do both well. Apple's tried to do both. And, you know, they've had some successes on both sides. But we didn't really see too many medical features out of this year's WWDC. And a lot of folks were expecting them. So it was a bit of disappointment in the medical community. And we did see a lot more wellness, which makes me wonder, you know, have they finally decided to pick a lane, or are they going to continue to try to do both and see, you know, what users are more attracted to? But I think, you know, it's just my personal opinion that they should pick medical, because I think that makes their devices more of a need to have. And it's actually for a huge population of people.
I do think that there are challenges on that front. I'm sure you know better than I do. I think there's like FDA approval in the way. There's the, you know, how accurate can some of these sensors be? There's also consumer trust. I mean, we can talk a lot about that. We did just go over how Apple announced this hand wash detection feature for watchOS at WWDC. What did you think about that? Was that like a good health play, you think?
Yeah, so I was initially thinking, oh, that's actually pretty cool, because most of us don't wash our hands correctly. I have trouble with washing them for a full 20 seconds. It's actually a really long time. And so that is, you know, somewhat useful for consumers. And I wondered, could it be used by doctors and nurses? And then, you know, very quickly heard from them that actually you're really told to take your jewelry off when you're in a patient room, just for purposes of hygiene. And then, you know, you're also supposed to wash up to the wrist. And so I don't know, you know, how that would, you know, the watch is, you're supposed to wear it on the wrist. So that piece of it too seemed less well thought through. But I think it's just sort of a generalized consumer tool, like here's how to wash your hands a bit better. Like that's, you know, it's something, and at least they're doing something to acknowledge COVID in this environment.
I think, I mean, I'm not sure if you've seen some of the news coming out, but a lot of wearable companies have also been sort of jumping on that whole, like, trying to acknowledge or do something with COVID bandwagon, I guess. Dan has sort of been following some of this quite closely. Aura, that smart ring company, apparently is working with the NBA to figure out some COVID early detection based on temperature, body temperature tracking. Dan, do you want to tell us a little bit about it?
So, long story very short, the idea is that, and it's a very crude way of detecting, and certainly there are issues with just being able to get good temperature detection in general when you've got such a small surface area. But the idea is that you will wear this particular smart ring for a prolonged period of time, and then it will be able to identify whether there is a spike in your temperature, which would then be sort of an early warning for the symptoms of COVID.
I mean, Fitbit also announced recently they're doing some sort of study by using the data that they're gathering from their devices to see how they can help to detect COVID symptoms early. Chrissy, have you heard about that?
Yeah, I've been tracking this as well. Yeah. It seems somewhat promising, but really early. And I think, you know, I'd love to see the data. I'm glad they're starting to do some studies around this. But I could see it, you know, temperature, for instance, isn't a particularly perfect system, because there's lots of folks out there that have are pre-symptomatic and don't have a fever. So, you know, maybe you catch some, but not all. It seems like at best, this is sort of a tool for a larger toolkit, versus something that we rely on.
Do you think that's... Yeah, go ahead, Dan.
I was just going to say, do you think that one of the challenges that all wearable makers have is that there's an expectation or a pressure that they will be able to discover a magic bullet that will enable sort of mass screening? But of course, one of the painful truths about COVID is that it doesn't necessarily manifest in the same way with everyone.
Absolutely. And that's part of the problem, is that, you know, there's some people are asymptomatic. Some people, you know, don't experience symptoms for 3 or 4 days. It is different for everyone. And then you have, you know, with wearables, you have this challenge of just how expensive they are and who's paying for it. And then all the same challenges that, you know, I'm sure you guys have talked about over the years, with just people get bored of them after a few weeks. They just forget to wear them. My Apple Watch is sitting, getting charged, and I've forgotten to wear it in 3 days. So, you know, that's a piece of the problem too. So I think, you know, again, it's not going to be a perfect solution. And I think they are under pressure to try to adapt to COVID, because every company in health technology is right now.
I find the wearable piece of it the hardest for me to understand, in the sense that, like, why is there this? I get that health technology can help, and I get that wearables are going to be a part of, you know, making telehealth more useful for a lot of us. I don't think that with something as changing all the time as COVID, or as hard to understand right now as COVID, that they necessarily have to feel this pressure right now. Or, you know, it's something that they could, I don't know, I don't feel like they need to feel this desire to be early detecting COVID-19, even though it will help. Does that make sense, Chrissy?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that there's, you know, to some extent, it could end up being a distraction because there is technology that actually can help for COVID that's more grounded in public health. You know, people have written about the Kintsa connected thermometer, for instance. That's a company that is you know, truly kind of connected and talking with public health every day, trying to figure out how the solution can be effective for this problem. Whereas I think some of these wearables companies, they sit more firmly in the world of tech.
Yeah.
And, you know, they want to do something and there's a potential for it to be useful for some people sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, you know, oftentimes these sorts of things can get overhyped because it's just sexy. The idea of a wearable detecting COVID.
Exactly. I kind of feel like that's what it is, right? Like, I feel like they're like, oh, we're a wearable company. We're in health. Oh, we got to say something. We got to do something. So, I mean, it's a little bit, I think, early days to see if any of these will work. But I do think that in general, COVID and this pandemic has really brought a lot of interest to the overall telehealth and healthcare industry. I'm sure your workload has probably increased a lot in the last few months as a health and health tech reporter. Are you seeing a lot of developments in this space?
Oh yeah, I mean, telehealth is just the hottest space right now. It's been around actually for a very long time, for decades, but we've never really seen utilization. You know, it's always been, these companies have always done these big employer contracts and they report, you know, 2-3% of people ever really use it. So it's I don't know whether it's a marketing problem or a usability problem, but you know, it's definitely in part a reimbursement problem. Doctors in the past haven't exactly, you know, for the most part haven't kind of flocked to it, and health systems have kind of wanted it to be at a lower end because they make more money when you go in,
of course.
But now it's just exploded. I mean, I've gone from seeing, I talked to one health system in New Orleans that said they had about 3,000 total telehealth visits last year, and they've had six figures. I mean, over 100,000 just in the past several months. So this is just insane growth. And I guess the question for me becomes, is it sustainable? Are some of the policy changes that were put in place by the federal government to make telemedicine easier, are those sustainable?
Yeah.
What happens in 2 to 3 months, or is this a temporary blip?
Yeah.
And my personal opinion on this now is that it does come down a bit. It's not going to sustain the levels that we saw in March and April, but we still do see increased demand for at least the next year, because there's a lot of people out there who are going to skip going to see, you know, the doctor.
Yeah.
They're going to be too nervous to go in person.
I'm with you. I agree that, like, you know, some of the federal regulations, the FDA approvals may not be lasting, and they might just go away back to letting the insurance providers make more money off of us from in-person visits. But I do think that overall, though, this growth and this surge in telehealth activity is going to be good for the healthcare infrastructure overall. I've spoken to a few people as well. One of the people I talked to, I'm not sure if you've covered this company before, is the co-founder and CEO of Roe. I spoke with Zachariah Reitano over there, and he kind of like explained to me, for him, his dad is a doctor. So the relationship that he has with medicine and the healthcare system, whatever, it's a little more like a friendly relationship rather than I have to have a huge lump before I go in to see my doctor, that sort of situation. And he, you know, reminded me, I have people in my family that are doctors too. And so for me, I'll ask my cousin what type of antibacterial wipe I should buy when Amazon's run out of Lysol. And she's an ER doctor. I really shouldn't be going to her for that sort of stuff. But that's the thing that telehealth is maybe what some people are hoping telehealth will do, which is let there be less friction between people going to see a doctor, you know, and therefore encourage them to be better about their health. Is this something you think is going to happen?
Oh, absolutely. There are people in rural parts of the country that just don't have easy access to a doctor at all.
Yeah.
And I think telemedicine, you know, granted they have some kind of device, you know, whether it's a smartphone or some kind of internet access, I think can give them, you know, a doctor that they can see primarily to talk about, you know, it's a lot of family medicine, essentially. But the other thing that's exciting that I'm seeing, you know, and Roe is kind of part of this trend, is just more specialization. So the first generation of telemed, it was just all kind of, it was trying to be kind of a one size fits all model. And now you're seeing companies pop up that are only treating trans patients, for instance. And that might seem like a smaller niche, although it's actually more than a million people in the US. But you know, these are people that sometimes have to drive three states just to find a doctor that is trained in, you know, being able to have empathy and be able to do that job. And it's now there's a way to do that online. And I think those things are really a very promising aspect of telemedicine. And I really like the way that companies are able now to drill down on a more narrow group of users and like really hone in on what the need is.
I'm going to ask what Dan thinks in a minute, but before we get to that, I, you know, when I was talking to Z, we're going to introduce a bit of the interview in this podcast. He talked about the idea of not only just talking to your doctors more, but also as the system and as these devices gather more data about you, there's just much more information to work with as well. And he points out an example of how doctors can better understand how to treat or look at the symptoms and analyze the symptoms of something like prostate cancer. And this is what he had to say.
You know, more recently, what people have been seeing with PSA levels. So when you get your prostate levels checked to see if you're at increased risk of prostate cancer, it used to be where people would look at the total value and say you're at risk if you're above 2. You know, 4 to 10 is more dangerous. But what they're now actually seeing is that the velocity of change of that blood test value is actually what is a greater indicator of a patient's risk of having prostate cancer. And so imagine if you're able to check a patient's PSA levels every 6 months, detect the velocity of change, and automatically notify their doctor or their providers or a team of doctors if there was something that was in and out of range. And so or that the velocity of change broke a certain speed or broke a certain barrier. You end up talking to a healthcare provider far earlier. And the earlier in your journey that you get care and that you can talk to a provider, the greater impact that you can have, right? The more significant they can help you change the trajectory of that journey. And so I think telemedicine is exactly as you described. There will be services, hopefully so many products and services built up that enable people to communicate with providers more continuously and really do see them as the friend who can help guide them through the healthcare system.
So yeah, I think Z is saying that like the more info we gather with all these devices, there are better ways to serve people with chronic situations too. What do you think, Chrissy?
Absolutely. And, you know, I definitely agree that this is kind of the new era of medicine that we're moving into. But I do have one caveat, which is just that, you know, there's this sort of big debate right now between the medical and the tech community about whether more data is actually going to make us healthier. And it would seem reasonably or logically that it would. But actually, you know, there are many circumstances where it doesn't. Because, you know, tests are faulty. They're not always accurate. And, you know, sometimes if people are given a lot of information, it can lead to people getting overwhelmed and anxious. And oftentimes that leads to more tests and more procedures, and those come with their own risks of complications. So I think we should be striving for more data, but we should do so in a way that, you know, is backed by evidence and is responsible, because the last thing we want is kind of an influx of the worried into our healthcare system.
Dan, watching from the UK, what are you thinking about the healthcare system here?
All I will say, given that the experience over here in Europe is so very different, my interest is really about whether this move to telehealth and whether the question of accessibility to healthcare completely is an issue of public policy failure or whether it's an economic failure, and whether we are reaching the point, and maybe Chrissy, you can speak to this, that what we will have is we will have an increased stratification where you have people who have very good insurance, who get all of these things, and then you have people on so-so insurance, but they've got access to all of these devices and, you know, can supply all of this data and can therefore take better care of themselves. And then the people who are sort of below that, who can't go out and buy brand new smartphones to be able to contact doctors through apps, who can't have, you know, who simply don't have money in their budget for the subscriptions or the fees to pay for this sort of access and then don't have the devices, are they then going to be left at the sort of very bottom of this food chain not getting the care that they need?
Yeah, I mean, you know, this is an issue. And right now in the US, we're seeing massive unemployment. And here, unlike in the UK, your health insurance is very much tied to your employment. So I don't know what's going to happen with tens of millions of more people outside of, you know, having a job, and what's going to happen to Medicaid. Are they going to be able to handle the influx? And, you know, there's definitely going to be more people that just don't have insurance. We already have tens of millions who just simply don't have any kind of health coverage. So all of that is a cause for concern. And when we talk about things like wearables and smartphone apps, we have to bear in mind that there are people right now that are looking to not spend money if they can, you know, get away with it. So we've got to make sure that we're not just creating solutions for people that can afford to spend a few hundred dollars on a wearable or an app, because I think we're about to see just even more disparity of health outcomes here in the US. And it's, you know, there's also, we have an issue here of just certain states having different policies around COVID. And because of those policies being different, some states have got, you know, huge outbreaks at the moment versus others. And, you know, in Europe, you can, you know, the UK and Germany and other countries are able to come up with a more centralized plan, and people in general, you know, I may be wrong on this, but it seems like they're sort of generally following the public health guidelines. In a way that, you know, isn't necessarily happening here across the board. So it's very different. I miss the UK. I miss the NHS, and I used to complain about it. I'm never going to complain about it again.
You know what? There's so much I would love to pick your brain on. I will continue talking to you off of this podcast, but I do know you have to go. We're really, really grateful you were able to join us today, Chrissy. Thanks, Chrissy.
Thanks, guys. This was really fun. Be happy to chat about this anytime.
And that's it for our very long episode today, everyone. Thank you, as always, for listening. Our theme music is by game composer Dale North. Our outro music is by our very own Terrence O'Brien. The podcast is produced by Ben Elman. You can find Dan online at
Daniel W. Cooper on Twitter.
And if you need me, I am talking somewhat intermittently at Sherlyn Lowe on Twitter. Email us your thoughts at podcast@engadget.com. Leave us a review on iTunes and subscribe on anything that gets podcasts, including Spotify. We will not be around next week because it's the 4th of July weekend. So go listen to an old episode or come back in 2 weeks for a fresh new one.
Oh, wow. Man, okay.